Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition event held in London in November 2023. This session was titled Addressing the Complexities of Sustainable Nutrition. Our panel discusses consumer demands, legislation, and labelling. They unpick the food industry's role in climate commitments, the nuances of communicating effectively with consumers in this area, and how to avoid unintentional greenwashing. Your host is the Trade Relations Manager at the Soil Association, Lee Holdstock.
To my left, we have Dr. Faye Cook. Now, Faye, you're Chief Impact and Financial Officer at Yeo Valley Production, where Faye leads on the company's finance, people, technology, and quality teams. So you have a PhD, Faye, in zoology, and you're passionate, as I know, about environment, climate change, animal welfare, and your particular interests are in sustainable food policy, are they not? And regenerative farming, and of course, holistic decision-making. Emma Pearcey joins us from Food and Drink Federation, where Emma is the head of climate change and energy policies. Having joined the FDF in 2019, you've worked in a number of policy areas, I understand, including energy efficiency, decarbonisation, and net zero. So currently, you lead on the development of FDF's sustainability strategy and the sector roadmaps to net zero. Now, moving on to Lucy, last but not least, Dr. Lucy Williamson. You have 30 years experience in food, farming and health. And you are a one-time vet, Lucy, as I understand, and now a registered nutritionist working to unlock the hidden health potential of our gut biome. So hugely, hugely relevant today. And you provide some nutritional consultancies, I understand, to climate-friendly food producers. And Lucy also founded the Gut Project, which aims to connect our food with the whole health from soil to us. So a very esteemed panel with a great deal of experience in this area. So as is par for the course today, I'm going to ask each of our panelists to kick us off. Way back in the 1940s, when the organisation I work for, the Soil Association, were founded, our founder, Lady Eve Balfour, had many quotes, but one of my very favourites was that agriculture should be considered the country's primary health service. So before we move to our discussion, I'm fascinated to hear some perspectives from each of you. So I'm going to ask for your initial reflections on the things we need to consider if we want a food system that enables us to eat both well and eat more sustainably. So Faye, I'm going to start with you.
Cool, thanks Lee. So when we're thinking about sustainable nutrition, I think the first thing we need to do is really unpack what we mean by sustainable, and that word does such a huge amount of heavy lifting. And the thing I always come back to is it's really important for us to think holistically and systemically when we're thinking about what do we mean by sustainability. So we heard a lot this morning about the importance of making sure that we're not zoning in on silo topics, hero topics when we're thinking about human health outcomes, whether that's fats or iron or whatever it might be. We need to think holistically. It's exactly the same from an environmental perspective when we're thinking about sustainability. So we need to be thinking about all of the planetary boundaries, not just carbon. So we need to be thinking about biodiversity, air and water quality, land use, nitrogen and phosphorus. There are a huge amount of things that we need to be thinking about, and they're all interconnected. So it makes it fascinating. It also makes it really complicated. So the second thing that I kind of think about is the WWF have done a really good job about thinking about that complex, interconnected web of sustainability when we're making our food choices. And they've come up with a really lovely model that brings all of that complexity into something that's quite simple for us to understand. Many of you, I'm sure, are already familiar with it. And it talks about the principles of more plants in people's diets, less animals. It talks about more whole foods, less discretionary foods, more variety in diets, And really crucially in my mind, all of their recommendations in that model point to the fact that our food choices need to come from a nature positive farming system. So that I find really helpful, and I'm really keen to unpack what do we mean by nature positive farming. The final thing I think I come back to is when we're thinking about the impact of farming, there's consensus that farming by far and away has the biggest impact when we're making our food choices, but that's where I think the consensus generally tends to end. And it's really important for us to be thinking about our standard calculation methodologies, by definition, have to lag behind the scientific evidence. So I think it's really important for us to be looking at the primary evidence, primary scientific data, when we're thinking about our decision-making and our food choices, rather than relying on outdated standard calculations.
Thank you very much, Faye. And I think it can't be overstated the impact that you're talking about. UNFAO calculate that our annual impact on the world from food production and farming is $10 trillion a year if it were costed in. So it's an enormous amount of money that if we had to go and clean up behind our food system, we would have to find. So Emma, same question. How do we eat well and eat sustainably? Your thoughts on that?
Thank you. So I'd just like to build on your comments around what sustainable nutrition means. And I think, you know, very well covered the environmental aspect there. But I think, of course, the additional elements would be, of course, the economic side. And that's the social side of things as well. And I think this year, with the cost of living, which I heard raised when I joined just before lunch, alongside the climate shocks that we've seen this year, have really brought to the fore the need for transitioning to a more sustainable food system. Because the reality is, if we don't, what we've seen in terms of price shocks will become more habitual, more normal, unfortunately. So, it's a bit rather sobering. But I think, you know, ahead of sort of COP28, you know, just around the corner, we do see that the role of food systems and sustainability has really increased, particularly over the last 2-3 years. And food systems, I think, you know, at COP28 will have the largest platform it has ever had, and that's over the space of 3 years. At COP26 in Glasgow, it was incorporated into Nature Day. The following year, they had a bit of talk, and now I think there's a whole pavilion on it. So, you know, that's really good to see, because, you know, when we look at food systems and actually then, sort of climate change. Food systems, or rather looking at actually food consumed in the UK, is about a quarter of our carbon footprint. Of that, two-thirds is from ingredients. In terms of embodied carbon, about half of that from ingredients sourced within the UK. So I think from this, we can actually see both the need to address both the carbon emission side of things, but more broadly how we adapt to climate change. So we're both responsible for the causes and consequences. There's a lot of risk here. I think something like 70% of fresh water use is used for agriculture as well. I mean, food waste as a sustainability topic. A third of food produced is wasted. It accounts for 9-10% of emissions. So many things we need to be working on. But in terms of what we're doing at FDF, and I'll sort of finish very shortly, and how we're addressing this is we're currently in the midst of developing our sustainability strategy. I've been working on this for the last year. 5 main pillars: net zero, nature restoration, sustainable commodities, food waste, and packaging. So I'm very happy to talk about some of that as we go through. But I think key to all of this, and has been touched upon already, is around the need for supply chain collaboration. And we all need to be working together. So it's just a great opportunity to be here today. And thank you.
Thank you, Emma. And of course, no prizes for guessing. It's going to be the same question to you, Lucy. But so again, back to the point, sustainable, eating sustainably and eating well, but perhaps some thoughts on the nutritional side of it in particular.
Yeah, thank you, Lee. Hi, everybody. So that word sustainability within our food, I always think it's great to remember that food has to sustain our health, which, you know, obviously we are talking about, but often its sustainability is thought about as far as the impact on the environment and on nature. And of course, food absolutely has to sustain our health. It's what drives our health. And so maybe we need to start thinking about our food differently. So rather than how it tastes and how it looks and the texture, but actually the nutrient density within that food. So what our food is actually giving us, and is it giving us what we need to drive our health? And because my sort of specialization is in the gut microbiome, that's very much looking at it from a sort of systems-based approach. If we can feed our gut microbiome, it actually impacts every single area of our health. So it's a very broad-based approach. But so nutrient density of our food, when we're thinking about sustainable food, which brings me on to my second point, which is I think we need clarity on the term plant-based. So the British Nutrition Foundation is quite a nice one to go with, where plant-based eating means eating food that is based on a diet rich in plants, but not exclusively. And that then means we are, you know, you can imagine your plate maybe being two-thirds plants, but the other third is perfectly possible and great to fill it with foods from animal sources, where sometimes we're actually able to absorb those nutrients much better. So iron being a great example, you know, at the moment in the UK, almost 50% of teenage girls are below the lowest level of iron intake, and it's very hard to absorb iron from plants, whereas we can get it very easily from meat. So we need to really define and to all sort of understand what plant-based means, but also within plant-based, it's obviously really great. We all do need to eat a lot more fiber, but sometimes plant-based foods are becoming very processed. So my third point is a lot of what we've talked about today I think we all agree that we need to reduce those ultra-processed foods in our diet. And, you know, when we process a food, our body responds to that food very differently. We'll absorb the sugars from it far more easily, for example. So certainly really taking control of the problem with processed foods, because actually that can be a driver of inflammation. And earlier on this morning, there was that was mentioned, the foods that drive inflammation in our bodies, inflammation being at the root of pretty much all chronic disease. So big picture thinking.
Thank you, Lucy. So I'm going to kick off with a question. Thank you all for your initial thoughts. I'm going to start with you, Faye. So there's a lot of choices out there at the moment for a sustainable shopper: regenerative, vertical farming, plant-based, all kinds of options. To what extent do you think consumers are grasping the nuances of what it means to eat sustainably?
Yeah, really good question. So I think it's incredibly hard as a consumer to know what to do for the best. There are so many messages out there, many of them really conflicting. And we also know that consumers, when they're at the shelf edge, have got a really short amount of time to make their decisions. It's like a couple of seconds for each food choice that they're making when they're at the supermarket shelf or wherever they happen to buy their food. So it's really, really difficult. We also know that when we are making our food choices, we're employing our system one thinking. We're making short, quick fire decisions. And those generally tend to be influenced by taste, cost, and a little bit of human health in our considerations when we're making our food choices. So actually thinking about the bigger topics of environmental sustainability aren't playing into consumers' decision-making when they are selecting products. So I think that means that the nuance is lost. It means that things like, you know, if we go back to that WWF guidance for food businesses, consumers might remember one or two snippets from that. They might remember more plants, less animals in their diets, and not necessarily remember the broader aspects of that framework. So that's where I think it's really important that all actors in the system are leaning into these challenges, are doing the deep thinking, are connecting the dots amongst themselves, rather than looking to the consumer to make those decision, you know, do all the heavy lifting. So that starts from policy, from government, from farmers to food producers to retailers. You know, we all have a role to play in helping consumers make better choices. And if there's one thing I could interject into that soundbite of less animals, more plants, it would be to insert the word better in both halves of those sentences, because then that's the trigger to remind all actors in the system to be thinking about those broader things, as Emma and Lucy have also touched on.
Sure, I'm going to come back to you on the subject of better in a moment.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go to Lucy next. We heard Jackie Lynch talking in one of the sessions earlier about the idea that influencers might, or marketeers might help us try to, or might lead us to focus on one particular quick fix, one supplement, one area of nutrition that we think we might be as short of, or is going to solve all our problems. Do you think, you know, the same is true arguably within agriculture and within sustainability generally? So do you think consumers are able or even willing to grasp any of this complexity? I mean, you're talking about gut microbiome, we're talking about the world between that and sustainability. In particular, the sort of interconnectedness of it all. Is this beyond consumers' grasp?
That is a great and a big question. I don't think it is, because I think now there is a wonderful thirst for a very natural approach to health, actually. So as a registered nutritionist, everything I do is evidence-based. But the brilliant thing about the gut microbiome is that although we have fantastic, robust science on how it works, it requires us to approach our food in sort of whole food, a very natural approach to that food. So maybe if I take as an example, before I get onto that though, your point about connectedness. So in looking after our microbiome, we want to have a lot of plants in our diet for sure, and a big variety, but we also need that food to be very nutrient rich. And we know from great research at King's College actually that if we also introduce some nice yogurt and maybe some high welfare beef and some good animal products in there that are giving us the nutrient density in our diet, then in those people we still see very, very good gut microbiome. So it's not just about the plants. But if we take it one step further and we look at how that food is produced in the first place, you know, you have 100 trillion microbes inside your gut right now. All of us do, working away for our best health. But actually, in healthy soil, a teaspoon of healthy soil has more microbes in it than there are people on the planet. So we've got this kind of uncanny similarity with what's going on in our gut and what's going on in healthy soil, and that soil is growing our food. So I think we're going to touch on sort of the regenerative farming principles and what that means and how that translates into the health of our food. But I think it's a lovely story for brands and for the food industry to take on board. You know, people want to know now where their foods come from. They want to know about animal welfare. And actually the thought that those foods are really driving our best health, as opposed to sort of commodity foods leaving a farm, goes into a very processed food and perhaps drives poorer health outcomes. You know, I think there's a fabulous story there that people are certainly receptive to.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to talk about that kind of almost seamlessly, that link between what's going on in our gut and what's going on in the soil. I think the Soil Association founders were talking about it some years ago, and I think everyone thought they were bonkers at the time, many, many decades ago. And it's interesting. I always reflect on the fact that the word human and the word humus, referring to the organic matter, have the same derivation. Yes. If you go back far enough, we literally are of the soil. not to be confused rather with hummus, of course, which is entirely separate. but this is you know, nature connecting with sustainability, connecting with nutrition. So just quickly bouncing back to you, Faye, you talked about nature positive farming, I think, in your intro, and you did express a desire to unpack that. Is this what sustainable farming looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I tend to think a lot about the term agroecology when I'm thinking about nature positive farming. And so just to give a sort of brief overview of how I would define that. Ecology is the scientific discipline of thinking about the interconnectedness and the relationships between living systems and the environment. And agroecology is taking the principles of ecology and applying that to a farming landscape. And in practical terms, what that really means is moving away from an intensive, extractive, industrialized farming system where we are ramping up yields by getting out the chemistry set, applying a load of human-derived synthetic chemicals into our farming system. Moving away from that kind of approach and moving towards a system that is holistic, working in harmony with nature, recognizing the fact that we are a part of nature, we are indivisible and inseparable from nature, so we can't strive to dominate it and intervene using chemical means and so on. And some of the principles of that that you would see in a nature positive farming system are things like taking care of the soil health, as Lucy has mentioned, integrating livestock. When we have livestock integrated well in a farming system, they provide natural fertility into the system, they help improve the soil health, they help promote biodiversity. You know, all these beneficial and interconnected holistic outcomes derive. And when we look at a good organic, regenerative, nature-positive farming system, we can also see not only is it contributing to beneficial environmental outcomes, it's also producing great quality food. Go back to the WWF matrix, produces a diverse range of food products. You take a good rotational organic dairy farm, for example. Yes, of course, you'll have great dairy. You'll also have beef. You'll have grains. You'll have veg. So, you know, it's contributing to a diverse diet, great nutritionally dense whole foods, and is also supporting that premise that Lucy was talking about earlier, where we strive for 70% of our diet to be comprised of plant-based products. So, I think that gives a bit of an overview in terms of what an agroecological farming system looks like. The real challenge from a consumer perspective is how the hell do you know when you pick up a product on the shelf whether this comes from a farming system where it's derived from oil and synthetic fertilizers, pesticides and so on, or how do you know whether it's an agroecological farming system? And that's where things like organic, I think, are really, really important to remember. Those principles are enshrined in law. It gives us a system that we can have trust in, and it is a system based on those principles of not cheating the system, working in harmony with nature. And so, you know, that is the fundamental piece of advice I would give any consumer, is look for organic where you possibly can, because it gives you that trust, it gives you that holistic system.
Well, I for one won't be arguing with that one. Emma, I mean, trust, consumers, it takes me neatly into a question for you. The CMA have been coming down quite hard on green claims now, and we're also hearing this new term, green hushing, where businesses are unfortunately, where they may have some great sustainability stuff to talk about, are reluctant to, for fear of getting themselves into trouble. So how can businesses offer improved information about their sustainability credentials, do you think, without greenwashing?
Yeah, there's different elements to that question. I mean, one of the things I'm just thinking is about who's the audience for this information. I mean, certainly I think from a consumer point of view, we really need to be moving to sort of, let's say, I say mass adoption, but we've got a cost of living crisis, and also 70% of our land in the UK is under agricultural production. We need to do whole system changes, and you know how we engage in consumer behavioural change to the masses is a key outcome. And I wonder whether I don't know to what extent labelling is going to be the answer for wholesale consumer behavioural change. It certainly will help some. And, you know, I agree with the comments that it will help with some choices. But more broadly, I think I heard just before lunch around the need for consumer education programs. And I think that's going to be a big factor. But going back to your question around sort of the data and claims, I think there's currently quite a lot of work being done around the Food Data Transparency Partnership that DEFRA is managing. And this is basically to help industry create an aligned industry approach to both data and methodology, firstly around carbon footprinting, and then to progress more widely onto other environmental metrics. And one of the outcomes will likely be around labelling. But I think even within DEFRA, they acknowledge that actually the main use of this will be in companies themselves to actually look at how to therefore then do a baseline and then reduce their environmental footprint from. And then in terms of this green hushing or you know, this aspect, how we utilise that, I think the investor community will be taking a very keen interest in sort of the disclosures around this kind of information, and it will be really important for financing, whether it be of different farming systems in terms of the supply chain or what food manufacturers need to do on site, you know, understanding where your risks are in the chain, what your footprint is, how you get seeking to address that. I think these will be vital questions which data will help with. But we do need this aligned industry approach, because otherwise, you know, you're comparing, and as they say, we'll say apples and pears or something. You're not comparing like for like. And we need to do that both for consumers and for investors, anyone to create that trust, I think.
And I think from a sort association perspective, I think one of the things that concerns us about sort of universal protocols for measuring sustainability is that there's a risk they can fall foul of an excessive focus on one thing like carbon, and that might come perversely at the, you know, to a cost to animal welfare, for example, as one thing gets played off against another. So, you know, are we viewing this philosophically, or do we need to sort of zoom out a bit and rethink these approaches?
Well, I think the most progress right now is being made on carbon. But very much in the scope of FDTP, it is around the wider environmental metrics, and certainly the work that the IGD, Institute for Grocery Distribution, is looking at are these sort of wider metrics to take that holistic approach. Because indeed, as we're seeing, you know, with some nature restoration activities, that there can be a bit of a focus on one metric as opposed to several. And I totally agree, we need to take a holistic approach.
Yeah, and I think one of the other concerns is you mentioned this sort of like for like. I think the approach that we've seen so far is very good for comparing an apple with a steak, if you want to get a sense of which is the most impactful, but it's not very good for comparing a grass-fed, organically reared steak with an intensive indoor-reared grain-fed steak. And they are very, very different product. So I guess, you know, I've got great hope for the process, because I think it's a worthwhile exercise. But again, it comes back to our initial point, doesn't it, about the nuances is all important in this, which creates complexity, which makes it harder to communicate. And so we go round. But coming back to the issue of labelling and getting that message across to consumers, as you alluded to, Fair, it's really hard. How do you encapsulate a holistic system of agriculture in one quick flash? And the organic movement has certainly tried. But is there any sort of, and I'm going to go to you, Lucy, sorry to pick on you, but I'm going to ask if you think there's any scope for innovation in this sort of labelling space to make sustainable choices, or feel free to pass that on to one of your other other panellist colleagues if you wish.
I think it's always good to get creative, and I think we have to keep in mind, as we've all been talking about, that generally consumers are time deficient, so it has to be something quick. And one thing that we've had some success with the producers that I've worked with is just using something as simple as a QR code. Mm-hmm. You know, you can quickly zap that as a busy mum going around the supermarket and you can tell your story. You can, you know, you can immediately look at the animal welfare or you can see where that product has come from. So I think, you know, some really simple things on packaging like that where you can actually... you're not confined to just, you know, a table or a, you know, that's actually really, really useful and something that the general public would find really helpful. I think the public find it handy if they can quickly look on the back of the pack and scan for ingredients. And it's always wonderful when you look on a list of ingredients, if they are ones that you recognise and that you think, oh, I've got them at home in my kitchen cupboard. So, you know, that's my sort of way that I tend to help people to understand if something is ultra processed or not. You know, do you actually recognise that the ingredients that are in it? So transparency over sort of using ingredients that we all recognise. But beyond that, it's probably beyond my skill set. Whether it's back to fame. Yeah.
Emma.
Just to say, I agree with you on the digital formats, very much so, because one of the challenges with data is that, of course, it can quickly go out of date. So by having it in such digital formats, and, you know, as we start to get more actual data in, then these can be updated frequently. But if it's on the pack, as you've got a challenge then of packaging ones, for example.
Sure. And quickly, Faith, labelling ever going to do it?
Well, from a personal viewpoint, I find it difficult to see how a simple label that a consumer can look at in 1 or 2 seconds and glean all of the information they need. I find it difficult to imagine how one label can do that. We also know, I completely agree with the points that Lucy and Emma have raised in terms of the innovation with QR codes and what have you, but when we look at the uptake of consumers, how often are they zapping those QR codes and reading the nuanced stories? The uptake's actually really disappointingly low. So it brings me back to the point I made in my introduction about the importance of all actors in the food system leaning into this. You know, looking around the room here, how many people do we have here where it's our jobs to think about this stuff, which is a great privilege. We're the ones who can freely share information with one another, share information with our customers, with our suppliers, be asking those challenging questions, be working together to solve these challenges across the food system, rather than putting all of that onus on the consumer. So one of the things from a labelling perspective or a data perspective I'd really be encouraging us to do is just sharing that information with one another really freely and be thinking about how can we solve these challenges together.
Very, very, very well put. I'm afraid it's to the end of the bit where your tame, friendly, cosy host gets to ask you questions and I let the room loose on you. So any questions for any of our panellists? And it would be very helpful, once we get a microphone to you, if you could just tell us who you are. And if there's, you don't have to, but if you could, it helps our panellists. And also, if it's for one of our specifically for one of our panellists, do say who it's for.
We've been talking pretty much for 2 days how things like the Mediterranean diet is great for us and our health. With my consumer sustainable hat, I don't want to buy tomatoes in January that is coming from Spain at the very best, or avocados that are flying from Mexico. How can we address that as an industry and also to help the consumer? Because I know all of this and still I find very confusing when I try to go to know what's the right choice from a sustainable point of view, but also from a health point of view, because I try to eat locally and seasonably, but there's some point where you get tired of cabbages through months and months. Thank you.
Who wants to take that? Lucy.
I'm really glad you raised that point. So the Mediterranean diet is a wonderful diet to base eating on because it's based on the huge range of plants. And the good news is that we've heard this morning, you know, that sort of thing of trying to reach 30 a week. And just to elaborate on that a little bit to make it easier, because it is really important that we try and eat seasonally. So plants, it's not just fruit and veg. It includes things like spices and herbs and nuts and seeds and beans and pulses and grains and cereals. So It's huge. It's, you know, it's very easy to actually, when you consider all the different types of plants that we have, and there are farmers now in the UK growing chia seeds and quinoa and all sorts of different types of beans and pulses, which we know are a really sustainable form of protein. So actually, just, you know, that would be my input, is actually think beyond just fruit and veg, because it's, we have a real lack of fruit and veg in the UK, other than, you know, going into that growing season in late spring onwards. So there are other ways, certainly, to fill the gap.
Just add on to that, that I think it's more than half of our fruit and veg are imported from abroad, and most of that from southern Spain, which is one of the top 10 water scarce areas. So, you know, there are a lot of issues that we're going to need to grapple with, and how we address that and create more sustainable supply chains. So, you know, I think that consumer education piece, it also it's in schools as well. It's going to have to come from multiple stakeholders so that we can start to get a shift and, you know, and take up some of these, I say alternatives, but to have that perhaps more broader diet.
And possibly a need to inspire consumers to get creative with these ingredients that they're potentially not familiar with. So if anybody wants to go out and experiment with lentils and beans, there is an excellent recipe book, not written by me, I can promise you, so I'm not plugging it. I just love this strap line, recipes to get your pulse racing. That's kind of one of my favourites this year. Anything finally on that one, Faye?
Yeah, I was just going to build on the excellent points already raised, and that is to talk about a little bit about processing. Processing per se is not the enemy, and it's ultra processing that we need to be cognizant of. So there's also a really important role for things like jarred and tinned tomatoes, as an example. Tim Spector did a lovely little soundbite on Instagram earlier this week where he was talking about, you know, the raw tomatoes being Nova Category 1, you know, as whole food as you can get. But then Nova Category 3, some of the tinned and jarred tomatoes, as long as we're checking the back of the label, making sure that there are no sort of chemical additives and what have you in there that indicate this is ultra-processed, they can be a really good and sustainable choice in our diets without having to venture into ultra-processed.
Sure, and it's also worth bearing in mind, whilst local food is a great, and I completely applaud it, if you want consumers to have an appreciation of agriculture and the challenges, then you've got two choices, really. For most people, is either watch Jeremy Clarkson's Farm, which if you can bear that, that's great. But otherwise, you know, better still meet an actual farmer and a real one and talk to them about their produce. But at the same time, bearing in mind that a product which was grown intensively using chemical fertilizer that's come from down the road still ironically might have a higher carbon footprint than one that was shipped in from the other side of Europe, which was grown organically. So again, sorry, a bit more complexity to throw in there.
It's surprising how small actually the transport element of our food
absolutely
footprint
it's
is.
Tiny. It's really small. It's really and we tiny. Get quite exercised about food miles, which is, you know, interesting. Any other questions from our audience?
Hello, I'm a freelance nutritionist and I also run workshops on gut health, but also soil regeneration. I just wondered if we could have something like a traffic light system for sustainable products. So that would be on package, but what would that even look like? And what kind of objective markers could we have that would make sense there?
I'll take that one. So the IGD, Institute for Grocery Distribution, will be presenting to DEFRA, I think at the end of this month, beginning of next, some proposals to cover environmental labelling, which, you know, is effectively a traffic light system. A bit of a mix with some scores, and they've trialled different options. So DEFRA will be taking that as one of the parts of research that they're doing, and I think we can expect to see a call for evidence in the new year, which will consider both sort of the future of the FDTP and what we're looking for from that, and how that evolves into the footprinting elements and then labelling to look at a wide range of metrics. So, you know, that's one of the options on the table, but I think we just need to be careful, as we've already said already, that this is not a silver bullet.
Absolutely agree. And just to repeat, what we said earlier, there is always a danger that the excessive focus on GHGs can see welfare played off. And I think one thing we really appreciate in the organic movement is there are a lot of externalities in farming systems, things that flow down through the supply chain that have surprising effects. I learned on a farm, I think it might have even been one of your farms, Faye, actually, I'm going to come clean, that avomectin wormers go straight through cows and they go into the soil and they kill earthworms, which doesn't really leave the soil in a fit state ecologically to be doing the job that it should do in terms of carbon sequestration. So, you know, we need to think about this. And one thing I would point to in France, really interesting, they've combined this up ABCDE scoring system with some sliders, a bit like the old graphic equalizer. If you're as old as me, you might remember those. But the idea is that you've got this score, but you're also showing sliders for animal welfare, for pesticide usage. So those things that sometimes these scores are not really considering. We've got time for one more quick question, I think.
Considering the diverse global food system, what strategies can you propose to bridge the gap between Western-centric sustainability narratives and unique challenges faced by regions with different agricultural traditions? Like, how do we respect cultural diversity while also maintaining sustainability?
That's a massive one with about a minute left, but if you could, if anyone wants to have a quick go at that.
No, just very quickly. So, yeah, our Western diet is certainly driving poor health. There's no doubt about it. And it's very important to learn from these traditional systems that actually are restorative to our land and produce nutrient-rich food. And I just wanted to draw attention to, there's one model that the Sustainable Food Trust, for example, have done where they've shown that, even if we went completely over to this agroecological way of producing our food, if we look at that food in terms of the nutrients that it provides us with, and if we reduce a lot of food waste at the same time, then there would be certainly enough food to feed us all within that system. So it's sort of changing within that very convenient Western lifestyle, changing our approach, I guess, coming back to what we said at the beginning about, you know, how we think about our food. That's a very broad brush answer to a big question.
Thank you. I'll take a slightly different perspective in terms of looking at international supply chains. So we import about 40% of our food. And, you know, thinking about then the impacts that that demand has on food systems in the countries that we import from, that's something that's, you know, of clearly of sort of major impact. And just thinking like with forest risk commodities, you know, that palm oil, soya, and impending legislation here, these are all things that have multiple implications, both in the environment but also sort of on the social side and community level, which are very much part of, you know, companies really trying to make sure that their supply chains are sustainable in all sense of that word, socially, economically, environmentally, both for where those ingredients are coming from as well.
Thank you very much. So I'm afraid we're out of time. So I think think holistically, be connected, don't be siloed, consider those interconnections. We haven't got time to sum up any further than that, but all that remains is me to say, please show your appreciation for our expert panel. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Before you go, I'd like to tell you about the Food Matters Live Sustainability Events Pass. It's one ticket that gives you access to 3 days of events covering sustainable sourcing and navigating EU deforestation regulations. Held in Ascot from the 15th to the 17th of April, you'll gain actionable insights on building cleaner, greener, more transparent supply chains and ensure you're ready for the new regulations due to come into force this year. 3 days, 60 expert speakers, and over 400 attendees. It's not one to miss. To secure your pass, just head to foodmatterslive.com. Thank you for listening.